TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Tuesday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia today. Yes, it's a real place. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, and glad that you've joined us today. Stacey Washington going to join us from Stacey on the Right here in about 20 minutes or so. Sean Maloney from Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors as well. We'll talk about the judge in Ohio scrapping Columbus's attempt at some local gun control laws. Also, next hour, Rodney Smith joins us from Georgia Firearms and Security Training Academy, which is a long title and a really interesting company. When we talked with Rodney, last time we talked with Rodney, he was training pastors on church security, which included but was not limited to, in some cases, an armed security staff there in churches. Right now, they are training a handpicked group of teachers there in Georgia at a private Christian school so that they will be carrying come fall. We've got some more school districts around the country that are actually doing this. In fact, we'll talk about what's going on in Madison schools in Ohio on the program this afternoon as well. Might even bring that up with Mr. Sean Maloney. Next hour as well, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins joins us from Breitbart. David Hassani at the Federalist in Hour 3, who says Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's factually challenged position on Israel is embarrassing. Julie Gunlock joins us from the Independent Women's Forum for a Nanny State update as well in Hour 3. And we have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy coming up at the top of Hour 3 as well. As a matter of fact, I kind of went a little overboard. You know, it's Tuesday, and sometimes we'll do two for Tuesdays. I think we're doing a triple Tuesday this time around. Cameron and I have three armed citizen stories, three deals of the day, and three good guys. So either I'm going to talk really fast, or I might spread some of these out throughout the course of the program.
So three for Tuesday.
It's a triple Tuesday here on Cam and Company. That's right. Yeah, got to do my radio voice. And my favorite headline of the day, this is for Cameron Gray. Justin, if you can have that San Francisco headline, if I can see that the last one that I gave you is actually the first one I'm going to use to make it really confusing. How San Francisco sends less trash to the landfill than any other major U.S. city. Cameron, how do they do it? I guess they just keep it right there in the streets, right?
Maybe it's their weird version of composting.
The punchlines, they write themselves. I mean, last week it's the, you know, actually not even last week, yesterday. And give credit, for whatever it's worth, to the mayor of San Francisco for actually acknowledging that this is a problem. You know, we talked about that major convention pulling out of San Francisco, medical association, doctors said they didn't feel safe there. And the mayor comes out and says, yeah, you know what, it's bad. We've got trash all over the place. We've got syringes. We've got people who are pooping in the streets. It's a real problem. It's a real issue.
Well, can't remember, too, the person from the convention bureau, the head of, I think it was Visit SF or something like that, even he said, we got a problem. So short of the mayor saying it, that's probably the second worst person who could say something is the person who's charged with bringing people to his city.
Yeah. Now, and I saw an amazing figure yesterday, something like the city of San Francisco every year, they estimate that the homeless population of San Francisco is about 7,500 people. And every year, the city, just the city, spends $280 million on the homeless population there in San Francisco, which I did back of the envelope math. Math was never my strong suit, but that's around $37,000 per individual. Now, if you made $37,000 a year, you certainly would not be living large. There are many portions of the United States where if you brought home $37,000 a year, you could live comfortably, have a small house, an apartment, food in the refrigerator, maybe a small car payment. But in San Francisco, you know, you make $112,000 a year right now, and that's, you're living below the poverty line. So I have an idea, Cameron, that the city of San Francisco actually use that money and build a new community somewhere in a more rural part of California.
away from, and then they, that has the added advantage of not having to live in San Francisco.
Right.
And then you have this new community.
It's funny, well, not funny, but it's interesting because you see the same story down in Los Angeles where they're trying to find places for people to live, and the liberal utopias that their residents are the biggest NIMBYs of all. They don't want any mm-hmm. part of it. They don't want homeless people. They want them helped and they want them taken care of. But when you say, oh, let's build some affordable housing close to you, let's build a shelter close to you. It's happening in Brooklyn right now, too. You know, some of these liberal utopias who they're going to help everyone else, take care of their fellow man slash woman. Nope, just do it somewhere else.
Well, what's funny is that, you know, you talk about not odd that you talk about the not in my backyard mentality in Los Angeles. That's one of the city's plans is literally, yes, we want to house the homeless in your backyard. They have this plan where you could build a tiny house in your backyard, and you basically get incredible tax deals. After a certain amount of time, you can then use that tiny house for your own use. You can rent it out as long as you put in your little shed there for someone who doesn't have a place to live in your backyard for a few years. Apparently, this is the voters agreed to pay $1.2 billion in taxes to help with the homeless city housing in Los Angeles County back in 2016. And yeah, I don't know. Apparently, the number keeps going up. 55,000 estimated homeless individuals in Los Angeles. Number grows to 58,000. If Glendale, Pasadena, and Long Beach included in the statistics, according to the LA Times, and the Board of Supervisors approved a $550,000 pilot program to build small houses for home workers who agreed to house a homeless person in August of 2017. So it's interesting. That's been almost a year. And I haven't heard it. I mean, have you heard any more about that? I remember that story at the time, but
I don't know what about it's interesting you're talking about this because something about this story is very interesting to me. I don't know why, because I've been just to both cities, especially San Francisco, which I think is just a gorgeous city. And it's just so depressing to see, you know, what these people – it's depressing to see what the city's, you know, the disarray and the disrepair. But it's also depressing for these people, too. It's just – the whole – everything's horrible. So I follow this story for some reason more than I probably should, being someone who doesn't even live in California. There was a story in the L.A. Times, I think it was last month, just talking about it, just the crushing problem that they have there. And the weird thing is this guy, Eric Garcetti, who under his rule in Los Angeles, the mayor of L.A., homeless population has just shot up so exponentially. And I'm amazing that this guy has his sights on national office. It's beyond me, but whatever. But there was an article in the L.A. Times just about this, and there was one part of it. It was like a photo essay, and I'll never forget this one. It's a guy in Malibu, you know, I guess a rural part of Malibu, and on his ranch, he built one of these shacks or small rooms, whatever you want to call it, a remote part of his ranch. He puts this thing up there. And this guy who was on the street for a long time gets this place. And they interviewed the guy who – they interviewed both parties. And they interviewed the homeless guy. And he said something that just so striking to me. He said, well, now I have a safe place for my art. And I'm thinking to myself, happy you have shelter, but maybe – needing a safe place for your art is why you're in this position in the first place. You'd think he'd be like, oh, now I can get on my feet. I guess now saying pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is like a bad thing to say or something. But that's probably the last thing I would have admitted to an L.A. Times writer is now I can focus on my art. And it just blew me away. I'm not saying he's typical. I don't know if he's representative. But the fact that they found that guy, it really struck me.
And the only thing that could have made that more Los Angeles if he had said something about working on a screenplay, right?
Maybe that was his art. Something in the film art.
Maybe so. Maybe so. There you go. Now, speaking of headlines, there's also this doozy from CNN this afternoon. Saw Alex Griswold tweeting about this, hashtag Griswold on Twitter. Here's the headline. We'll just go ahead and show that to you. Alex was wondering, what's going on here? Chris Isidore from CNN, NRA and other nonprofits will no longer need to identify their donors to the IRS. Okay. So then you actually read the story, and I think we've got maybe the first paragraph of that CNN story. Here we go. Some nonprofit groups will no longer have to give the IRS the names of donors who give them $5,000 or more. Among the groups that will no longer have to report donors are the National Rifle Association, various chambers of Congress, and groups focused on particular issues such as Americans for Prosperity, which has been closely associated with the Koch brothers. But the ruling also applies to groups like the NAACP, labor unions, and volunteer fire departments, as well as Everytown for Gun Safety, which has a 501c4, because that's what the rule applies to, is 501c4s. So why was this written? Why was this written, Cameron, so that the casual reader, oh, my God, the IRS bending over backwards for the NRA and the Coke to puss. Do you think that was a little intentional there?
Why, you say casual reader. I'd love to know what the actual percent is of people who click beyond the headline. You know, people just see that tweet, scream about the NRA and the Koch brothers for a few minutes and move on. And it is pretty clickbaity as well.
It's very clickbaity. Yeah, really clickbaity. Even the opening paragraph. I mean, it's one thing to have the clickbait headline. I think we're all kind of used to that. And if you don't read beyond the headlines, please do. That hurts my heart when you don't read beyond the headlines. That really does. As somebody who, you know, listen, I was a radio reporter rather than a print reporter. But if you only listened to like the first 10 seconds of my 40-second report, you wouldn't have gotten all the info. Go ahead and if you've clicked on the headline, take the 2 minutes to read the actual story, and then maybe go and take another 2 minutes and read another story about that same subject. And see, compare the two. See what that first story left out or what the second story didn't have. You have to. And nobody's going to do it for you. And the government's not going to pass a law mandating that the media shape up. We have a First Amendment. It's on. And the media is not going to fix itself. That's the other problem. So it's on us as consumers of news and consumers of information to look beyond the clickbait headlines to try to get the full story there. And you had to do a little bit of digging there in that CNN story to find out, oh, okay, so it's not just the NRA and the Coke-to-Puss network there that's going to be benefiting from this, but it's that all 501c4s. And no, you're not going to find any mention of Everytown's 501c4 in that CNN story because reasons, I guess. I don't know. They ran out of time. But but now you know that, yes, this is a little bit less than meets the eye here in terms of the IRS and a shadowy conspiracy going after and helping the conservative organizations. Oh, my gosh. One more story quickly before we got to take a break. Cameron, speaking of shadowy conspiracy theories, yes. What do you know about this this QAnon stuff? Do you know anything about it? Do you just know the phrase?
I know about it. I know enough to not be interested.
Yeah. No, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, you can go down the rabbit hole with this stuff, and it's just like someone types something, and it's like it means a billion different things to people. It's not for me.
You know, again, I just can't get beyond the, okay, so some random person on 4chan is claiming to be some sort of person, and you're just accepting it, you're just buying it, okay. Well, the 4chan person says, so I gotta believe it. But anyway, yeah, I know, and I'm right there with you. Like, I don't see how anybody can really be falling for this. But I saw this story earlier today. This just blew my mind. There was there's an app that is supposed to like alert you anytime a news story has been written or anytime, you know, there's a new 4chan post or whatever that's not just, you know, trashing your mom, but is supposedly about this conspiracy. And it's a paid app. And Apple has removed this from their app store, which, of course, Cameron is now going to just fuel more conspiracies that Apple is in on this. But this was, according to this news story, this was in the top 10 paid apps on the Apple store and was the number one paid app in the entertainment section of the app store. Right? That was mind-boggling to me. That just absolutely blew my mind. So, again, I have nowhere to go with that other than if somebody just anonymously tells you on 4chan that they're a member of the government.
The only reason people know about 4chan is because they hoax people. And there's a lot of some of it's pretty incredible that they get people to do some things. But it's very strange. And the thing about the people who believe in that stuff, I don't know what they're searching for. I don't know. It's when you look at it, like I said, you can go down a really deep rabbit hole of, you know, someone had a heart emoji, and that means now, you know, this person has no heart, and the, you know, the seventh rising of the sun in Mercury. I mean, they're just the craziest theories, and I don't know. I never understand conspiracy theories, but this one is very strange because they're assigning so much importance and so many things that are just not there. It's kind of fascinating to watch, but I feel bad for some people who are just so damn into it.
I know literally what I read in a couple of news articles today because I've read more than one. But yeah, and that's about as I mean, it almost comes off as like this. On the part of whoever's, you know, putting this out there as like this weird performance art piece. Oh, Cameron, I wonder if it's that guy in L.A. who now has a safe place to work in his art.
That would tie this segment up perfectly.
It runs deep, man. It runs deep. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right joins us. Stick around. We're just getting started here on this Tuesday edition of Cam and Company.
More people dream of moving to America than any other country in the world. It's true. 150 million people would drop everything to come here if they could, because they desperately want what so many of our leaders seek to destroy: the freedom to speak your mind, worship your God, build a business, leave a legacy, and defend your life and your loved ones. These are the basic building blocks of the American dream, an idea that still captivates human hearts like nothing else. In this time of such uncertainty and doubt, we must hold fast to the principles of freedom. For it is with these timeless ideas, not the elites who scorn them, where the hope of mankind still rests. We're the National Rifle Association of America, champions of civil rights and freedom's safest place.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children and freedom's safest place.
It's as patriotic as it gets. A gathering in the heartland of folks from all 50 states. Welders, salesmen, farmers, accountants, soldiers, first responders. Here, we're all the same. Here, we are all race fans. We are proud of our country, proud of our military, proud of our drivers. We proudly stand for our national anthem, and we have a great reverence for names like Yarborough, Earnhardt, Waltrip, and Gordon. Yes, there are other NASCAR races, but this one is special. 500 temper flaring, finger waving, ego busting 15 second laps. And deep into the warm August night, hardly a seat in the last great Coliseum will be used. You see, this isn't just a race. This is America's night race.
Our fans are super patriotic. We love that. Our fans are loyal, patriotic, and I have a brother that's in the military, so that kind of really hits close to home for us.
Thank you to the men and women out there fighting for our freedom. We wouldn't be here today doing what we do and driving race cars and you know, live out the dreams of our lives if it wasn't for you. So thank you for keeping our freedom free and fighting for all of us.
Bristol Motor Speedway. The place where you can forget about work for a while. Celebrate the good old USA. And take in the best bumper-banging, fist-waving, hero-making short track race of the year. The Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's America's night race. This is what you live for. So be there August 18th. It ain't just another race. It's Bristol, baby.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. We are a month and a day away
with the Bass Pro Shops Inneray Night Race. And, of course, you can get your tickets at InneraryRaceTix.com. I get so excited just watching, seeing that video there from Bristol. So looking forward to being there. Coming up later on in the hour, Sean Maloney joins us from Buckeye Farms Association, member of the Inneray's Board of Directors as well. Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right is with us on the program right now. Stacey, how are you today?
I'm pretty well, I think. I hear Kristallnacht has occurred, and we are in a new era of Hitler because Donald Trump wasn't mean to Putin yesterday. So I'm waiting on the cattle cars again, but other than that, I'm doing great.
Yeah, well, it's Tuesday, so just wait. By Wednesday, it'll be EDM in and Stalin rolled into one. I know it's.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I want to ask you what's going on about something that's going on in Missouri and nationally. We've got in Washington, D.C., obviously, the confirmation fight for Brett Kavanaugh. And, you know, Stacey, there are a lot of think pieces out there right now about the conundrum that this poses for red state Democrats like Claire McCaskill from there in Missouri, a U.S. senator, a Democrat in a state that went handily for Donald Trump. And I read a Politico piece that said that there are already, ads going up on the airwaves attacking Claire McCaskill. Is she going to stand up and vote for President Trump's nominee or not? Is this starting to play out politically in Missouri here, just a few months before the midterms?
Well, sure, it is. And the National Republican Campaign Committee, the big parent Republicans, decided to infuse the Hawley campaign with cash. And, I've openly said I support Josh Hawley. I just want to beat Claire McCaskill. I think many of the candidates who I've interviewed, a bunch of them, they're great people. But I think Josh Hawley has the best chance to win because he has the name ID across the entire state. And so they made this decision to spend money in Missouri on Josh Hawley before the primary is decided. And that has kind of enraged the grassroots. And now people are saying never Hawley and all this other stuff. So it's really, it's become quite a distraction on our end because we want to see a strong candidate come out of the GOP primary in order to face Claire McCaskill. That being said, Claire McCaskill has had many opportunities to show Missourians that she understands our values and she understands that the state is, it's the show me state. We love divided government. We love to have the Democrats have a say in our government. And we have our major population centers, of course, are heavily Democratic. And then the outstate, the rural areas are like solid red. So that dynamic has to come into play for people who are wanting to be elected here, especially to the Senate. And Claire McCaskill has been very successful at winning and keeping her name just moderate enough for Republicans to, stomach her being one of our senators. But this is a different ballgame. The state went for Donald Trump by double digits, and his down ballot, coattails were so amazing that all other candidates and comers against Republicans were blown out handily. So people who had kind of a slim chance of winning won handily on the coattails of President Trump. So that being said, you would think she would, kind of moderate her positions on immigration, try to reflect the electorate here in Missouri. There's so much information out there that shows that Missourians are pretty traditional. They can be moderate in some areas, but for the most part, it's the heartland. It's the center of the country, and she should reflect that. She doesn't. On every position, from guns to abortion, she is very, very, very liberal. And so with this Kavanaugh nomination, she has a chance to show Missourians that she really does understand out where we come from, who we are. I don't think she's going to do it. My money is on her voting against Kavanaugh because that's what she's done in the past. She was a deciding vote for Obamacare. She's been many times opportune to, showing us that she could be moderate and reflect Republican ideals while still being a Democrat, and she's never done it. So we'll see, but it is starting to heat up here. I think the monkey wrench that they threw in by deciding to give funding to Hawley early before the primary was over, it was really an unforced error, and I'm hoping that we can recover from that and still beat Claire in the general.
Talking again with Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right, and so your prediction is that Claire McCaskill ends up opposing Kavanaugh, siding with other members of her caucus. Okay, so yeah. I suspect that you're right. I mean, when it came to Judge Gorsuch, Claire McCaskill is not one of those red state Democrats who voted for him, like Joe Donnelly and Heidi Heitkamp and Joe Manchin. They were the three who did cross over and vote for Neil Gorsuch for the to confirm him to the Supreme Court. Okay, so this is the other conundrum, though, right? So if you're Claire McCaskill and you decide, all right, I'm going to stand with my caucus, don't want to jeopardize any of my Democratic senatorial campaign committee cash, don't want to have any donor issues, so I'm standing with my caucus. Donald Trump won Missouri by 19 points. Certainly Josh Hawley, as you say, is going to be portraying this as a move by Claire McCaskill that is out of step with the wishes of voters in Missouri. How bad does that decision? I'm sure it helps her with their donors. I'm sure it helps her with the fundraising and all of those efforts. But how much does voting against Brett Kavanaugh cost her among the electorate in Missouri?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a crapshoot. It's one of those things where it's so weird. So, Cam, you've got Missouri. Okay, on the whole, it's a deeply red state. We have super majorities in our legislature here at the state level. But then there's another dynamic. Out in the rural areas, these school district superintendents control everything. And they've had a huge blow dealt to them because unions can no longer force members to pay dues. But the implementation of that Supreme Court ruling, that's where the rubber's going to meet the road. How will they kind of circumvent that ruling to make sure that they can still get that money, which goes like 99% of it goes to Democrats. And it's for get out the vote efforts. And they're supremely proficient at it. It's like it's their bread and butter. So you've got those parts of the rural areas. And so Claire McCaskill has strongholds in areas you would think wouldn't give her the time of day because teachers unions kind of control some of these outstate areas. So the dynamic here is one where she's already been up to it. If you watch some of her clips from MSNBC over the past 6 months, even though she voted against Gorsuch, she did so in a way that made her seem like she was just a grandma trying to do what was best for grandkids all over Missouri. And, you know, she even can sound a little bit more like an outstate Missourian, Missouri, you know, that type of thing. She has this persona of someone who, if you bumped into her at the grocery store, the two of you would end up talking about my kids and her grandkids, and we'd wave fondly at each other as she walked away. But when it comes to the issues that matter to people, like taxes, she'd be fine with increasing taxes. She's rich. She lives in a $2.4 million condo in D.C. When she's here in Missouri, she has a palatial estate. She and her husband own several private planes. She doesn't like traveling on the bus tours, so she sends a bus around, and she flies on the private plane to tiny airports to meet the bus so she can get on it and then get off so people can see her. I mean, this is not that grandma at the Schnucks, which is that's what we call grocery stores around here. It's a family. They run our grocery stores. This is not the person you meet at the Schnucks and you strike a conversation up with who really is just somebody's grandma. She sounds like that on MSNBC. She sounds like that on CNN. But in the back dealings, read her book. She's a hardcore political operator. I think underestimating her is the peril of Republicans. And I don't think they're doing that. I think everyone's aware of how cunning she is and how easily she could turn the election on one interview, as she did with Todd Akin a few years back. She could turn the election on an interview, a poorly done interview, a poorly worded response, any issue. She could capitalize on it, take to Twitter. She'll still be the grandma on TV. She'll be cutting throats on Twitter, and she'll get it done. So my voice to everyone out there, I'm crying out in the wilderness, don't underestimate her. Turn out to vote and make sure that you put those signs up for whoever the eventual Republican nominee is, probably going to be Josh Hawley. Put the signs up for him, support him. And, you know, just don't count Claire out. She's out there working and strategizing, and she could very well win in November.
Because the primary, Stacey, is not until next month. Is that right, in Missouri?
Right. It's in August.
Okay. All right. See, I can't keep track of all these primary schedules. And there are some that are even, like, later in September. All right. So,
yeah.
Listen, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, this is something that we've been hammering on the program every day. It's the height of summer right now. November seems like a long time away, but get involved now, right? And if you've got a favored candidate in the primary, work for them. And then in the general, work for, whoever's going to best represent your right to keep and bear arms, is going to safeguard those rights. But yeah, now's the time to get involved. I mean, you can't wait until October. You can't wait till the kids go back to school and Labor Day comes and goes. Because we know that there are people out there around the country who are working every day to ensure that this is an historic election, that, you know, any pro-Second Amendment advancements, any protections for the right to keep our arms that Congress currently affords, that those are gone, that there are no more Second Amendment or no more folks who can actually read the Second Amendment who would be nominated to the Supreme Court. The stakes are incredibly high here. And this isn't something where we can just, you know, roll out of bed on election day and go and cast our vote and say, all right, I did everything I could do, because that's not everything you can do.
No, it isn't. And the other thing that's interesting about the primary when you talk about being in August is most people don't pay attention, because by the time August rolls around, you're just getting back from maybe your summer vacation or whatever you've been doing around home, your staycation. And now your kids are back in school and you're just trying to manage all of the different events that they have the first 2 weeks of school. You're like freaking out about that. But the fact is, this primary is going to be really, really consequential, because we also have Prop A on the ballot, which is the Democrats were successful in getting enough signatures to get our right to work bill put up for a ballot referendum. So the entire state's going to vote on whether or not we get to keep our right to work laws. So Claire McCaskill is obviously pro-union, and the primary, the last time she had a primary and the Republican challenger was really strong, John Bruner was so strong and he was going to beat her. She sent 200,000 Democrats to vote for the primary candidate on the Republican side she felt she could beat, which at the time was Todd Akin, who was a good man, but he made a kind of, he flubbed an interview about abortion after he won the primary. And then she wrote a book about it to teach other Democrats how to do the same thing in open primary states. So I can't stress it enough. This is a woman who right now she has a plan for which of the candidates on the primary side she'd like to see win. And if you want Claire McCaskill and 200,000 Democrats to decide who's going to be her opponent, then stay home and be really obsessed with your schedule and the kids and stuff. Or you can turn out in August and make sure we get the candidate that we know can beat her, because that's what she's most afraid of. She's terrified of Josh Hawley. I get an email from American Bridge every day about how horrible Josh Hawley is. She's running ads on all of the conservative websites that you and I visit on a daily basis, saying Josh Hawley is corrupt, trying to link him to supposed scandals by the president. And that is effective if you see it 27 times or more. It won't work on a hardcore Republican like me, but it might work on someone who's uninformed, who might see those videos online, and she's got them everywhere. It's like a carpet campaign. So she's smart. She knows how to win, and she's an attorney. She is a grandma. She's Catholic. She doesn't practice, but she's a Catholic. And so she has a lot of demographic value that she can plug into, and she knows how to put on the voice and put on the face. So it's important. August is the primary. Make sure you're voting in that for the candidate that you feel like, you know, you can support in the general that will beat her. And moving forward after that, you just have to be there in November. And you talked about get out the vote efforts, donations, all of that. I support all of that. I think people should do everything that they can so that on election day or the day after election day, you don't have regrets. But I also think, you know, you just have to know who your opponent is. If you look at Claire McCaskill's history in the Senate, if you look at the way she votes, she doesn't reflect Missouri values. And she's really not good for American values on the whole because of her partisanship. And the Kavanaugh vote is going to be really great because she's going to get to showcase once again who she really, really works for. It's not us. And we can use that to capitalize on her other votes that have not been in favor of Missouri values. And I'm hoping that that'll be enough to swing it and that we can see someone who really, really cares about Missourians and will vote to reflect what we are actually sending them for in the Senate, that we'll be able to elect someone like that.
All right. One last political topic for you there in Missouri. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Stacey, you know, has captured the hearts and minds of Democrats around the nation and the media as well. And I saw this story a couple of days ago. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will stump for Cori Bush in St. Louis. So Cori Bush is hoping to unseat a Democratic Representative William Lacey Clay in August, and so I guess Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is coming to town to stump for the insurgent candidate, and she's doing this for a lot of candidates around the country, by the way, and it's really ticking off the Democrats who are already in Congress, who are saying, hey, That's not how you do things. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that there are some on the left who don't quite, I mean, you talk about not underestimating Claire McCaskill. Listen, don't underestimate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and this movement and the challenge that it poses for, you know, the establishment Democrats and the Democrats who are entrenched in Congress right now. I mean, I've been saying that if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is elected in November, the next time the Democrats take over Congress, she'll be their speaker. And I'm not kidding. They will certainly run her, and who's going to dare say no? I'm curious about this, though, the insurgency, the Democratic Socialist coming to St. Louis to stump for a Democrat in the upcoming primary. Is that making news at all? And do you think that
sure.
the Democratic Socialists, are they in danger? Well, I shouldn't say in danger, but are they in a position where they could have an outsized influence in Missouri politics?
They could. I wouldn't say outsized. So the thing about Democrats is that it's like, so they, I call it that they've been kind of slow dancing with socialism for about 25 years now. They've been teaching it to American kids in K-12 public education. They've romanced it to the point where they then have this independent who's a Democratic socialist named Bernie Sanders who caucuses with them and then decides he's going to run for the presidency on the Democratic ticket. And instead of them saying you have to be an actual Democrat to run for president as a Democrat, they let him do it, thereby validating him and taking the number of Democratic socialists in this country from 6,700 to now well over 25,000. They have hundreds of chapters now in the country, and they're opening new chapters like every week. They legitimize something that as an American should never be legitimized because socialism is just communism light and it's killed hundreds of millions of people on this planet. It's never worked. So here's where I feel like they've made their own demise by legitimizing this. Ocasio-Cortez is the child of an immigrant family. They came from a country that practices socialism. That's why they had to come here. Now she, as an adult and a graduate from a really good university here, the recipient of the largesse of really, she's benefited from being in our company. She has benefited from being on American soil and taking part and tasting the fruits of capitalism. And now she wants to institute socialism. She is a great poster child for it, but don't ask her any hard questions. She's now all over media talking about how she supports the two-state solution in Palestine and how she doesn't support it. She doesn't really have much depth on the issues, but that's never mattered to Democrats before. So yeah, she's going to travel the country. She's going to enrage Democrats. She's going to go all over. But when people understand what she really wants, like universal income, universal housing, the government to own the means of production, that, you know, she's not sure capitalism is for the future. It was good in the past. She attributes capitalism's success to evolution. There's a lot of crazy comments for her. I think she's going to find herself pretty alone in if she's elected in November in Congress because she doesn't have a lot of friends with the people who make sure you get reelected. So yeah, 20% of the vote there. She trounces this entrenched Democrat. He's no longer the number four. He's gone. It's a feat, but does she have staying power? So she can come and campaign and, you know, have all the fun you want, drink the wine, drink the champagne, love it up, do the tweets, but does she have staying power? I'm not so sure, but the Democrats made this bed and now they're really unhappy to have to lie in it.
Stacey Washington, listen, we got a scoot, unfortunately. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today. It's great talking with you.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
You bet. Stacey on the right on Twitter. And this is amazing. So this is probably the first time I've been on Facebook, Cameron, in like a year at least that I've just actually even clicked onto Facebook because I wanted to find out more information about this appearance by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Hosted by Cori Bush for Congress. This is going to be Saturday, July 21st at the Ready Room in St. Louis. It's Cori Bush's birthday. It's going to be a get out the vote effort. But then besides that, like to the right of it on the Facebook page, they have related events. This is all this in St. Louis. This is all this week. There is the We Deserve a Vote, petition campaign kickoff and training, which is Saturday. There's the Abolish ICE in Family Separation Rally on Thursday. There's the Homes for All mass meeting on Wednesday. There's the Canvas for Cori Bush on Sunday. There's the Vice President Pence / America First Policies protest on Thursday. I mean, every day in St. Louis, if you want to protest something, there's something for you to protest. Every day, if you want to go out and you want to hang out and protest, there's something for you to do.
There was a protest yesterday, pretty much the same group, same kind of people. And there was a sign, and it, what, abolish ICE, you can discuss that, fine. But it said, you need to get rid of borders, the CBP, and prisons. So we're going to get rid of prisons, too. It's just, if you want to have a sign chanting abolish ICE, great. But a sign that says abolish prisons and eliminate borders, I don't, why are you wasting anybody's time? It's never happening.
You know, it's, but again, that's what they want. And I guess give them credit for being honest. All right, stick around. We got to take a timeout. When we come back, Sean Maloney of the Buckeye Farmers Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors, will join us on the program. We'll talk about what's going on in Ohio, where a judge has scrapped a challenge to the state's farmers preemption law by the city of Columbus. Stick around. There's much more Cam and Company on the way right after this. We're spending some time with Butch Wyden from Cryptech. Butch, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. And Jen Dolphin from Prefix. How are you, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing great, thanks.
And this is an absolute beautiful beast behind us right here. What are we looking at?
Well, this is a very special and unique project. This is the Cryptech Edition Dodge Ram Minotaur 1500. And it's an aftermarket vehicle that Prefix, Jan's company, has assembled in collaboration with Cryptech, the NRA, and several other great brands in the industry.
So this is, we as NRA members, we've got the opportunity to actually win this truck, right?
Well, there's going to be 150 of these trucks made, but this truck specifically, NRA members are going to be able to win. Not just the truck, but an absolute amazing package of gear from great brands such as Weatherby, Leupold, Springfield Armory, Tenzing, Boyd Harness, Wiley X. There's about $25,000, Nosler ammo. There's about $25,000 of additional outdoor gear that's going to come along with this truck. And some lucky NRA winner is going to, our member is actually going to be able to win this truck that's well over $100,000.
Golly, okay. We're gonna talk more about how folks can win this. But first, Jan, let's talk about what's involved in this actual, you know, Dodge Ram Minotaur. What makes it so different and special?
Oh, absolutely. So just to clarify, Prefix, we're the company that builds most of the concept cars and prototypes for the auto industry. But every couple of years, we have a little fun. We find a vehicle that we think we could make better or enhance, or we think there's a niche market for. And so the Minotaur truck was built as an awesome daily driver. It's kind of built as the as an equivalent engineering-wise, like a Baja race truck. So on the highway, it's fantastic. But it's got 14 inches of suspension travel. It's the real deal. You can jump this thing, and it is just a beast.
Well, as somebody who actually owns a Dodge Ram, I can tell you that my Dodge Ram 1500 looks nothing like this Dodge Ram. I'm drooling right now. I'm having to actually keep my mouth closed.
That's perfect.
And so, you talk about the suspension. What about under the hood? What are we looking at in terms of, you know, horsepower? Right.
Comes with the 5.7 Hemi, which is a great motor for this truck. We do offer an optional supercharger. Like I said, we're building 150 of these. It's very low volume production. We love that exclusivity because that means that there's a good chance that the guys that own them are going to be the only guys in town that have them. And as Butch said, then there's one lucky guy who's going to get not only to win a Minotaur truck, but it's also going to be loaded with the prize package. So this
we're going to be able to start entering this lottery or this raffle here early March, and this is going to run for a year. Is that right?
That's my understanding. The NRA will really make an entire launch at the convention this year and open it up. And then all of the marketing and collateral start to go out and open up to NRA members. And then my understanding is that next year at the 2019 convention, they're going to pull a name out of a hat and somebody's going to win over $100,000 package.
I'm going to be entering. Are you going to be entering, Butch? Are you eligible? You're eligible, right?
I think so.
I mean, it's just a random drawing. All right.
If I wanted, I'd turn it back in. You know, that's always cool when that happens.
And re-raffle it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a bold move for you, Butch.
Right.
I don't know that I'd be that generous, but this is amazing. And so tell me from your perspective, what was it like being involved in this project?
Well, it's kind of an interesting deal when Prefix reached out to me and we started to have the discussion, hey, we'd like to talk to Cryptech about doing a Cryptech Edition Dodge Ram truck. You know, you have to be like, first call's like, yeah, right, whatever, you know. But then as we started the relationship and we started to understand what they were looking for and how this truck was a very you know, badass vehicle, and they felt that it, our brand nested well with the attitude of the truck.
He's being too nice. we knew we had done a lot of testing with these vehicles. We already had started selling them, and I was looking for something that we could do to really increase the excitement. And when we learned about Cryptic and their camo pattern, it was the attitude that this truck needed. It's exactly what it needed. So starting to work with Butch, kind of understanding the background of their company, Prefix is known, our tagline is excellence is expected, and we knew what we were putting into the vehicle. But to add this Cryptic attitude, very patriotic, very cutting edge, awesome, awesome look to the truck was just perfect. And we're getting the response because of it, for sure.
Well, for those who can't put down a deposit, we can buy a raffle ticket. NRABigTruckGiveaway.org. That's going to be the website that you need to go to enter this.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Coming up about an hour from now, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart. Right now, I want to welcome from Buckeye Farms Association, member of the NRA's board of directors as well, Mr. Sean Maloney is with us on the program. Sean, how are you, sir?
I'm having a great day. How about you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. And good news coming out Friday afternoon. Sorry that we could not get you on the program Friday to talk about this, but Franklin County Common Pleas Court Judge David Kane, who was considering this challenge to Columbus's new gun control laws brought by Ohioans for Concealed Carry and Buckeye Farms Association. He made his ruling, Sean, and what did the judge decide?
You know, it was all day Monday we litigated that case, and I had a good feeling when I left. He decided that Columbus, on its face, violated preemption with banning bump stocks and binary triggers and other accelerating devices. And he slapped them down pretty good. I could tell by his demeanor that he was a little bit peeved by the fact that we were even in court dealing with this, because what Columbus tried to do was take the word accessory, because accessory wasn't in 9.68, and say, well, you can say a bump stock's an accessory, and since it's sold as an accessory, it doesn't fall under preemption, and we can ban that. And then the judge determined in several ways that that was ridiculous, and Columbus quite frankly lost, and they lost badly on those issues.
Okay, that is good news. Now, as the city of Columbus decided what they're going to do, I mean, first of all, what is there what legal options are available to Columbus? Can they appeal this up the line here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they can appeal that to the Court of Appeals for Columbus, and probably they won't, just based on the other appeals that we've had, Clyde and the other cases coming out of Cleveland. There's probably not much hope for them there. But what they did do is Columbus also enacted its own domestic violence statutes, and the judge let those stand for the time being. So we're considering appeal on those issues. There wasn't a state law dealing with minor misdemeanor cases of domestic violence. And we followed the federal law in the state of Ohio, but Columbus wanted to be able to go out and arrest their own people for MMDV cases. And so the court let that challenge, or let those ordinances stand. But as far as the bump stock and any component parts or accessories with firearms, they flatly overturned that. So there could be potentially two appeals heading up. We could appeal the judge's decision to leave the ordinances where they have expanded Ohio law for domestic violences and other cases that weren't formerly violations of Ohio law, and they can appeal the court's decision also. I doubt they will. In fact, we have a conference call as soon as I get off here today on what we're going to do, so I'll keep you tuned in.
Okay. In the meantime, Tom, I don't know why I called you Tom there, Sean. Sorry about that. In the meantime, I do want to ask about something. I saw their locally Madison Schools in Butler County, Ohio. They approved, I guess several months ago, they approved a policy to have armed school staff. And then, I guess several weeks ago, the gun control groups got involved here, right? Every time for gun safety. And I don't know why they picked Madison Schools, but they sent a letter to the school district. They're trying to raise a political hay about this. There have been a couple of school board meetings, including, a town hall-style meeting. Mm-hmm. Since then. I've seen no indication that the board is backing down, but have you been following what's going on there in Madison Schools?
Yeah, in fact, last Friday I was at that, I think it was 2-hour or 3-hour session, public hall type meeting, where essentially what happened is they allowed everybody to get up and speak again, because it had actually passed some 2 months ago unanimously,
right,
that Madison was going to arm teachers. Then somehow someone contacted Bloomberg and Everytown for gun safety, and they sent an attorney in who filed a letter, said we need to be heard. And so she was there from Columbus with one of her partners. And essentially, the decision had already been made, so the school board just sat there and listened. And they listened to probably an equal amount of people. Of course, all the red shirts were there, and people not from Madison saying that it was wrong to arm teachers. But I would say the vast majority of the people who actually do live in the school district were there in support of their school board. They wished it could have been a little bit more transparent, but you have to point out that it's law that matters concerning school safety and security can't be discussed in the open. And I think that probably was a little bit of frustration for the people, but once they learned that, they certainly understood. And it's interesting, I think that's Bloomberg's kind of his new playbook. They're going to attack local areas, local school districts. As I mentioned before, Bloomberg sent people into Columbus, and I'm sure he's sending people in against us next week to support the city of Cincinnati's bump stock ban. We won in Columbus. We filed a suit against Cincinnati, and I litigate that, I think, on the 24th. So they send people to town for that, so I think they're really going to get involved. And you could tell that it was Michael Bloomberg that was there, in fact, just by the same people, the same comments. And tragically, they flew a grandmother in from Parkland whose granddaughter had died. And, and who can't feel bad for that? It's a tragedy. But basically, all she had to do was talk about how they should ban AR-15s. And as did a lot of people, they weren't even talking about the issue of arming and protecting children. So, you know, it's sad when Michael Bloomberg moves in from wherever he hails from now and tries to overtake the minds and the decisions of the local parents who just want nothing more than to kiss their children when they get back from school every night. So, and I went there, and I was interested in hearing, well, what's your other option and what other course of action are you going to do to protect kids? And they had nothing to offer, not that I expected them to, but it was kind of their three-ring circus that they put on. But what we should notice is that Moms Demand Action seem to be locally having parties and recruiting members. So I think they're probably putting up a little bit stronger fight than they have before in the past.
You know, and that's something that we've been talking about again on the program here, is that these gun control groups, don't underestimate them. They're very savvy. They're mm-hmm. smart. And they are using, again, every avenue that is available to them to try to advance their agenda, however small it might be. So they are showing up at those school board meetings. Even if it's, you know, 12 of them, they're still there. They're showing up at these city council meetings. We know that they're getting involved. They've got at New York University right now, School of Law, Sean, they've actually got a clinic. So they've got law school students who are working on nothing but gun control issues with Everytown for gun safety, right? I mean, they do see this as a prime opportunity for them to make inroads around the country, including in places, you know, small rural, relatively rural districts like Madison mm-hmm. schools. I think 1,400 students there in the school district, but the gun control groups are going to be there, so we need to be there as well.
Absolutely, it's kind of, I look at the Bloomberg plan and what they've done. They're kind of walking it down. They couldn't do anything at the federal level, so then they tried to get into the state laws. They tried to run legislation there, or they tried to defeat our legislation, and they can't get that done. So then out west, they try to do referendums. We saw what they did in Colorado, what they did in the state of Washington and Oregon, and that seemed to be what they were going to do for a while, was run referendums. And then suddenly, they're showing up in our backyards. And I noticed that at committee hearings in the legislature these past 2 years, that more and more they're showing up. But one thing I did notice is that a large number of them weren't from Ohio. But I think that's changing now too, because the people that are more or less stationed in Ohio are recruiting members of Ohio to try to give their voice, you know, a little bit more pitch or a little bit more strength. So by all means, we have to be vigilant. We can't let these people take over. Again, they bring 12, 13, 14 people to a school board meeting that maybe only gets 5 or 6 people on a normal course of action. So we have to make sure now that we show up everywhere. And it's important more now than ever. That's where the fight is. They brought the fight to our front doors. And actually, that's the best place for us to have it, because especially in the state of Ohio, control with school districts, it's all local. It's all local control. So it makes it a little bit easier. And I think there are some people that were upset because they see their neighbors there. Most of the neighbors are on their side, but then these people that they really weren't sure who they were or where they were from stood up and tried to take their decision away. They voted support in Madison for the school board and said, we're behind you 100%. And then all of a sudden, two attorneys from Columbus come in quoting the wrong Ohio law, telling them they can't do what they've done. So it's different now. It's changed. The face of this fight has changed.
Absolutely. Sean, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Thank you for everything you're doing there in Ohio, and hopefully we get a chance to talk again soon.
Thanks for having me, and I'm hopeful that in the next week or so we'll have some good news from Cincinnati.
Me too. Sean Maloney joins us from Buckeye Firearms Association. Stick around. Coming up next hour, Rodney Smith joins us from Georgia Firearms and Security Training Academy, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart. And we'll be back with more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm here with Joel Weems with WSI Sports. Joel, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, we run into each other at shows like this, and I always ask you the first thing, Joel, what are you doing here?
You know, I make beautiful underwear, and someone's got to cover your undies, and that's me. I'm your guy.
And you're also a cold weather. You're from Minnesota, right?
Minnesota, we know cold.
Yeah, you guys know cold. My wife's from Minnesota, and man, oh man, I think it affects you for life. So, but she's always saying, wear your long underwear, wear your long johns. Like, I think I've worn long johns where I came from, PA. It's just not a thing to do, but when you're out there or you're out in the field hunting or doing something else, you need to have that kind of coverage. So
good underwear.
So give us an idea a little bit about WSI Sports. What are you all about?
Yeah, well, I started the company 27 years ago, and we're all about making products in the USA and getting great innovative products. You know, America has the best technologies in the world, and I'm just capitalizing on that. And, you know, I love to see people grow and make it local.
And you go not just, because you do stuff for a lot of sports stuff, NFL and other things like that. What was your sort of entree into, you know, a show like this where you have hunters and outdoorsmen? How did you get into that direction?
Well, it was kind of a natural, you know, gravitating to the outdoor and hunting. A lot of these consumers love the Made in USA. They love technology. We got a great resource local around Minnesota, and they need good, great cold weather products, and that's where we really have focused a lot of our energies.
So you do your real field work out in Minnesota.
Yep, we're getting out there with our underwear on.
Do you wait Joel, till it gets like, you know, 5 degrees with the wind chill to minus 25, then you send everybody out in the undies?
I love it. I love it. Now, it was 72 below. I tested some of my product at 72 below wind chill.
Wow.
And I said, hey, you know, we got the testing field right here. We got to capitalize.
72 below.
It was amazing.
Amazing. It's scary. all right. So Joel, we're here with Joel Weems with WSI Sports. Give us an idea of the line, what you guys make.
Well, a lot of it is more underwear, as we talked about, kind of base layer products. We like to basically create products that can be thinner, lighter, warmer. And we also have, you know, antimicrobial for the, you know, the no smell and stink and odor. And we'll cover you from head to toe.
So whether when you're talking about, oh, that's an important thing, whether it's a football player or someone in sports or working out, or whether you have someone, a hunter or an outdoorsman in the field, it's important. This stuff is going to be going through not only just some extreme conditions of weather, but extreme like physical conditions too.
Well, I tell you, I remember growing up as a kid, we'd go to northern Minnesota, we would walk out to our tree stand, you work up a frickin' sweat. You get up in that tree stand and sit there for 10 hours.
And you're cold.
And my dad said, you got to stay up there. And it's like, boy, I'm freezing my butt off. We got to come up with a better solution.
Yeah, and my thing I remember, before we got on the air, Joe, we were talking about socks. So that's got to be an important thing, because that's what kills me is when you're out and you got boots on, whatever, you're sweaty, and then your socks, you're wearing cotton socks, they get all wet, and it's the worst.
Our heater socks are amazing. One of our best sellers, because if you can keep those feet dry and warm, critical. That basically sets the tone medically, physically.
Right. Yeah.
For you know, your system.
You're right, because when you get cold like that and you're out, it sets a tone in your mind where you just cannot warm up.
That's
and
right.
It can be dangerous when you're out there doing that. So speaking with Joel Weens with WSI Sports.
And the term cold feet, getting cold feet.
Yeah, it ain't funny sometimes. So Joel, how can people get more information about WSI Sports?
WSISports.com, WSISPORTS.com.
All right, WSI Sports, Joel Weens. Great stuff. Good to see you again. You know, when you head back from the show, just stay warm out there in Minnesota for me, will
Amen.
You, please? Because I worry for you, man, all right?
Hey, we love it.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company starts right this second. Coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia today. On the program this hour, Rodney Smith joins us from Georgia Firearms and Security Training Academy, training some teachers in Georgia here. Also, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart joins us, talking about some of the big Second Amendment stories around the nation. In hour three, David Harsanyi at The Federalist joins us. His latest, Ocasio-Cortez's factually challenged position on Israel is embarrassing. Julie Gundlach will join us on the program as well. And, you know, we were talking with Sean Maloney about what's going on in Madison schools there, Butler County, Ohio. The gun control groups getting involved after Madison schools said, yeah, we are going to have an armed teacher program. We're going to have these teachers go through the FASTER program. And they found some parents who objected to this idea, who are now, I guess, showing up at these school board meetings and continuing to object to this idea. Politico had a piece today, Caitlin Emma, in their morning education briefing, a poll out, and this is going to be the takeaway headline for most of the media here. Parents opposed to arming teachers. That'll be the headline. Parents are broadly opposed to arming teachers. 63% of parents are opposed to arming teachers and staff to bolster school security, according to Politico. Now, they also do note that when you talk to these parents more about what actually takes place, if you just ask an average parent, hey, what do you think about arming teachers? This poll says about two-thirds of them say, I don't like the idea. But if you say, okay, so what if we had a program that teachers could volunteer, they would be vetted, and then they would be trained, 80 hours of training on the use of force, along with weapons proficiency, legal issues, and first aid. This was approved by the school board as well as local law enforcement. What do you think about the idea of arming teachers? Now, all of a sudden, it's about 50-50. Instead of about two-thirds opposed and a third supporting, now it's about 50% supporting, about 50% opposed. Just because you give them more information. That's it. That's all it takes, is to actually tell people, here's how these programs work. And what's sad is that, what this tells me, by the way, is that most people don't have any idea that that's how these programs work. Right? If you're able to, if you know, again, you go from a third of people supporting this to half of the respondents supporting this, simply because you give them more information, they haven't gotten that information yet. And I think a large part of that is the media reporting on this issue. Now, it should be noted, Stephen Gutowski of the Washington Free Beacon was out in Colorado at their FASTER training. I think Laura Carno said they had some other media outlets there. Sean Maloney and the folks in Ohio with FASTER welcomed in some media crews recently to their last round of training. So this may be changing slowly, but right now it's up to us. And for these school districts that are considering these issues, it's up to these school districts, I think, too, to actually talk about what these policies and procedures are going to be. Because the more information that the parents have, frankly, the more supportive they are. You know, we just saw this last week in Lee County schools in Virginia. They became the first county school district in the state of Virginia to adopt an armed school staff policy. And again, they're not mandating that teachers do this. It's not, well, this is now part of the conditions of your employment. They're getting volunteers that will be vetted.
They will be trained, and they will be there as that first line of defense to protect the students. They're under their care. And in Lee County, like a lot of these districts that we're seeing around the country, they talked about putting school resource officers in every school district. There are 11 school buildings in Lee County, Virginia. It's a pretty rural county, right there in the tip of southwest Virginia, right up against the Kentucky border. And they don't have the money. They just simply don't have the resources to put school resource officers in every one of these school buildings. So this is what they can do. And this is what they are doing. And again, there are hundreds of districts around the country that are doing the very same thing. So this polling, by the way, comes from the PDK poll, which is sponsored by the Phi Delta Kappa International Association for Educators. Joshua Starr, the CEO of PDK International, said, we hope these results will be used to inform policy and activities around the critical issue of school safety. The big takeaway is once parents are actually aware of what these programs are like and the training requirements and the vetting process that these teachers go through, they become much more supportive of this. I hope we can continue to get this information out there. And it's probably worth noting those folks and those institutions that don't really want that information to get out there, those who want that first assumption to be, well, Army teachers, anybody can just walk into school there and say, I'm an Army teacher now. Again, when folks are misinformed or uninformed on these issues, that helps the gun control advocates. When they become more informed on these issues, that tends to help those of us who are not anti-gun. All right, we've got, again, Rodney Smith going to be talking about what's going on there at a private school in Georgia here in just a little bit. We were talking last hour, Stacey Washburn from Stacey on the Right, about Missouri and Claire McCaskill, a red state Democrat, who is weighing right now what to do with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. There are a number of Claire McCaskill's colleagues who find herself in that same situation right now. Red state Democrats like Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin, John Tester, Joe Donnelly. The blogger Tamara Kay at Books, Bikes, and Boomsticks, who blogs out of Indiana, noticed a new campaign ad up on the airwaves right now. And it's run by the Senate Majority Project. It is supportive of Democrat Joe Donnelly in Indiana. The Senate Majority Project trying to become the Senate Majority. So got to keep Joe Donnelly, got to elect a few other Democrats out there, and make Mitch McConnell the Senate Minority Leader. No longer we have to fear the turtle. And then Chuck Schumer will become the Senate Majority Leader. That's what they're hoping for. So they got this new ad out. And as Tamara writes, the Senate Majority Project ad complains that, quote, out-of-state billionaires, the Koch brothers, are buying ads to smear Indiana Joe. That's what they call him, Indiana Joe. And as Tamara notes, the Senate Majority Project has gotten a couple of million dollars from Michael Bloomberg, who is a billionaire. Got at least $10 million from NewsWeb Corporation, which is Chicago billionaire Fred Eichner's company. So you have on the airwaves in Indiana right now an ad, as Tam says, complaining about out-of-state billionaires that was bought and paid for by out-of-state billionaires. How about that? There you go. That's what, and by the way, look for a lot more of those types of ads coming between now and November. We talked last hour about that CNN story on the IRS changing the reporting rules for 501c4s. Now, this is for all 501c4s, which are a fairly common nonprofit. The headline for CNN, NRA and other groups, the Koch-topus, they're all going to benefit from this, as will volunteer firefighters and the NAACP and a couple of, they kind of bury that. Remember that story we talked about? I think it was last week out of Georgia, maybe the week before last. In the seat currently held by Karen Handel, You got a primary coming up in Georgia, and two Democrats who are vying to take on Karen Hinnell in the general election were arguing about the support by Michael Bloomberg. And one candidate, who did not get the endorsement of Moms Demand Action, was complaining that the candidate who did get the endorsement of a Moms Demand Action should, since she was opposed to Citizens United and she wants to see an end to corporate campaign dollars, he called on her to renounce the financial support of Michael Bloomberg. She countered by noting that he had specifically asked on Twitter for some financial help from Michael Bloomberg, which did tend to undercut his argument. But she also falsely stated that there was no quote-unquote dark money associated with every town, even though every town has a 501c4 that falls under the exact same provisions as every other 501c4 out there. And the local media actually in Georgia did note, yeah, she got that one wrong. Local media in Georgia pointed that out. National media not really going to be that interested in noting, again, the similarities, the sameness and the ubiquitousness of 501c4s across the political spectrum. You know, maybe it's not just the clickbait headlines, Cameron, that we got to caution people on. Maybe it's the clickbait ad campaigns, too.
Oh, good luck. That would be one hell of a regulatory commission.
A lot of this is up to us as consumers of information to look beyond the clickbait and to actually try to get to the kernel of substance, if there is one, contained within. Now, my favorite election story of the day comes from New York State, and it's not an update on the 21st district. It's not Tedra Cobb, who was caught on tape again saying that I support an insolvency ban, but I just can't say it publicly or else I'd lose the election. No, the New York Times is reporting on the 19th congressional district, which stretches through the Hudson Valley and Catskills region, currently held by Congressman John Faso, and it's being challenged by Antonio Delgado, who is the Democratic nominee for Congress. Rhodes Scholar, Antonio Delgado is, graduate of Harvard Law School, former lawyer at one of the country's largest lobbying firms. But the New York Times, Estead Herndon writes, for all of Mr. Delgado's accomplishments, it's another part of his past, a fledgling rap career under the stage name A.D. The Voice that is receiving the most attention in the early days of his race against the Republican incumbent, Representative John Faso. In 2007, Mr. Delgado released a rap album featuring lyrics that criticize capitalism and America's history of racial injustice. They include frequent use of a racial epithet common among black rappers and criticize some... What would that be, Cameron? And criticize some of the founders as, quote, dead presidents who believe in white supremacy. The New York Times reports Mr. Faso is trying to use the lyrics against him, saying that they are, quote, inconsistent with the views of the people of the 19th District in America. In response to questions from the Times, Faso said Mr. Delgado's lyrics are offensive. It's his responsibility as a candidate to answer for the controversial views he expressed in his lyrics and whether he continues to hold these views today. Democrats in the 19th Congressional District feel very differently. And they say it shouldn't matter. In fact, the New York Times went to a farmer's market in Rhinebeck, New York, to get the pulse of the electorate there in the 19th district. And at a recent farmer's market in Rhinebeck, Mr. Delgado's hometown, several residents expressed outrage that Mr. Faso is attempting to frame Mr. Delgado's rap career as a political hindrance. The most critical said that Mr. Faso was resorting to racial demagoguery, unbecoming of the district, and echoing the divisive language that has sometimes emanated from President Trump. Others said they simply wished both candidates would focus on the policy issues closest to the district, and even Mr. Delgado's most explicit lyrics should have no bearing in the congressional race. Matt Stinchcomb, Rhinebeck resident who was strolling down Main Street on Sunday with his family, said he wasn't surprised the race had already turned personal. Mr. Stinchcomb, who helped start the popular e-commerce site Etsy. Yeah, just randomly on the Main Street in Rhinebeck. So the rap album was a, quote, non-issue for him. Said, quote, I don't know how much of this is racial, but it certainly seems like an attempt to paint him as an outsider. This campaign should be focused on if these are the people who represent my values, and that's it. So I'm curious about this. If somebody wrote a book 10 years ago and then they ran for office a decade later. You'd look at their book, right? I mean, that would be fair game to talk about, well, you wrote this 10 years ago. Do you still believe it? If you produced a, let's say, go back with me, Cameron, to the early 80s. Let's say 1983, Blackie Lawless of Wasp. Let's say that in an alternative world, Blackie Lawless of Wasp runs for Congress in 1994.
Okay.
Does his albums come up in that political race?
I would imagine.
I would imagine.
I don't see how.
I would imagine that they wouldn't. Yes. Yeah. So I'm really curious as to why it is that you can't talk about. And what's interesting is, so 10 years ago, when this candidate Antonio Delgado, 80 The Voice, came out with his album, it's called Painfully Free. I don't know how well it did, but the website Hybrid Magazine reviewed it at the time. Gave it a very good review, by the way. So the album features hardcore hip-hop rap numbers that tear into society's hypocrisies and imperfections, but he also has songs that rejoice about life and have a genuine appreciation for people. Delgado spoke in a recent webcast interview with his alma mater, Colgate University, and again, this was 2007. Spoke with Colgate University and said, quote, hip-hop is misunderstood. He hopes to broaden people's minds about the genre and the scope of hip-hop by infusing elements of orchestral and classical music. His debut record shows hip-hop slash rap to be a way of life, speaking his mind freely and finding courage from within. What makes Antonio's album special is that for him, hip-hop is a philosophy to live by, the way Confucianism is to others. Hip-hop in its purest form conveys the plight of the underprivileged. Delgado does that while appreciating the little gifts that come into life. It gives the album a good balance while showcasing his vocal chops. So, again, they gave the album a good review. And they didn't, here's the thing, they didn't say it was mindless twaddle, right? This wasn't just a bunch of party anthems. This was supposed to be kind of deep. This was supposed to be thoughtful. This was supposed to be philosophical. So why can't you talk about that? And if you're the candidate, if you're Mr. Delgado, look, either you agree with, either you still agree with what you felt in 2007, in which case you say, yeah, I might not put it that way anymore, but I still agree with what I said back then, what I meant and what I felt back then. Or you don't, in which case you say, that was 11 years ago. And, you know, look, I may have been a Rhodes Scholar back then. I may have gone to Harvard Law back then, but I didn't know everything. I thought I knew more than I did, and I know more now than I did 10 years ago. And here's where I've changed. Here's where my points of view have grown. I don't get the whole, well, he made an album a decade ago, and now you can't talk about what he said on that album a decade ago because he was bashing America, because he was bashing capitalism. And again, that might not appeal to the voters in the 19th District in New York, so now you simply can't talk about it. That seems weird to me. Does that seem weird to you, Cameron, or is that just kind of where we are now?
I think both answers are equally valid. It's weird, and that's where we are now.
Where we are right now. Yeah, there you go. We're in a weird place at the moment, I guess. So, I don't know. Blackie Lawless, by the way, if you're out there, you know, it's been like 30 years. So, apparently you could run, and I don't think anybody's going to say anything. I would advise not wearing the chainsaw codpiece, though, on the campaign trail. That would be probably an OSHA violation, if nothing else. All right, when we return here on Cam and Company, Rodney Smith from Georgia Firearms and Security Training Academy joins us on the program. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart later in the hour as well. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up next.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together collectively. And that's why I wanted to say, I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA. with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours. So no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military. And I've only come under fire a couple of times. But if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and the desert warfare, where you don't know who the, where the enemy is and who they are. And I won't forget the men who died. Well, everybody knows Bristol's a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium, and they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's such surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special, because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh, you just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, you know, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
I do know what it's like to be vulnerable. I know what it's like to feel like you can't protect your children or yourself. And it's terrifying when you have a spouse, whether it be husband or wife, that's serving overseas thousands of miles away, and you're the only one there to stand up for yourself, to stand up for your home, for your little kid that's right there next to you. I support the Second Amendment because of that. I support the NRA because they support my right to protect my kids. Everybody has a right to life, and you have the right to protect that. And nobody has the right to take it away from you.
My daughter came into the bedroom and she said, "Dad, there's a man in black tactical gear shooting up the Baptist church." Every one of those shots to me represented one of my neighbors, one of my friends. And I ran as fast as I could. Immediately, he came out of the church shooting at me. He hit the truck in front of me, hit the car behind me, hit the house behind me, and I hit him. He had an AR-15, but so did I. And it's not the gun, it's the heart. It's a matter of the heart. I'm not the bravest man in the world or anything, but I was here. I was here, and I could do something. And I had to do something.
I'm a law-abiding citizen who's never shot anybody, never committed a serious crime, never committed a felony. But it seems like every time we have one of these shootings, nobody wants to put the blame where it goes, which is at the shooter's feet. You want to put it at my feet.
I felt like I needed to say something for all the people out there that I just spoke about, the people who have come together, who are together, who feel unified. That majority of people who obey the law, you know, and work hard every day, and are just tired of people trying to pull them apart and pull them in all different directions. I think there's millions of me across the country, and I'm hoping that each one of those people will go out and tell these politicians we're not going to take it, and we're going to stand up for our rights, and we're going to hold on to them. Anyone who is concerned with holding on to the Second Amendment, I absolutely think they should join the NRA.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Coming up about an hour from now, David Ersani of the Federalist Right Now. I want to welcome to the program once again from the Georgia Firearms and Security Training Academy. Mr. Rodney Smith is with us on the program. Rodney, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. We got some great weather down here in Georgia.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, July, boy, it could be really like just 90% humidity. You have to swim to work. So I'm glad to hear that. And you got a lot of stuff going on right now. What can you tell us about the latest training that you're doing, Rodney?
Yeah, we got a ton of stuff going on. Tomorrow we are teaching teachers at a local, I'm not going to mention a name school, but it's a private school. It's a Christian school. And we are going to be training over a dozen teachers on active shooter. The class is going to be broken up into two segments, which is phase one and phase two. Phase one, which is tomorrow, is nothing but classroom training. And we're going to cover trauma. We're going to have gunshot wounds we call plugging and patching. I have a Navy corpsman that's on my team, and we're going to have him come in and do a 45-minute plugging and patching, quick emergency type stuff. Then we're going to get into basic pistol. Of course, these teachers probably haven't shot very much, so they're going to get some proper training, basic fundamental types things, and then we're going to get into use of deadly force as per Georgia Code 16-3-21. Then we're going to get into room clearing, security measures, communications, all that type of stuff like that. It's just like SWAT. We're going to train these guys just like SWAT. That's how we're going to train them. Fact, they are going to be the first responders to any type of situation, and these are all volunteers. And then what we're going to do after that, within a day or so, then we're going to take them to our private outdoor training facility. We have 68 acres, and we're going to teach them use of cover, shooting and moving, drawing techniques, any kind of threats, situations like that.
That is awesome. And I'm curious, Rod. I mean, this is a private school. Does state law in Georgia allow for public schools to designate any members of the school as armed security, or would that be something that would need to be changed via the legislature in Georgia in order for public school districts to adopt similar policies?
Yes. In Georgia, they passed the House Bill 60, I think it was a couple of years ago, that states that a school board can authorize certain individuals to carry guns. However, they have to have training, professional training of nature like that. Yes, sir.
Okay. And you know, are you hearing from more districts that are talking about this? And what was the decision-making process like for this school? Because, you know, one of the things we were talking about earlier this hour, there's a new poll out. And when you ask parents, do you support arming teachers in schools? About two-thirds of them say no. But when you are able to give them that information of, okay, well, what about if the teachers were volunteers? What if they were vetted? What if they were trained and they had 80 hours of training and this is all the training that they went through? All of a sudden, support jumps up from about a third to about 50%, Rodney. And so I'm curious, I mean, do you know what these discussions are like when these school districts or these private schools are deciding, you know what, this is actually something that we want to proceed with?
Yes. The big thing is about training. Again, I'm a big fan of having, training even for your carry license, your carry permit, whatever you want to call it. It all depends where you're at. I'm a big fan on that. There's a lot of states out there, just like Georgia, doesn't require any training at all to get their carry license. However, back on the school situation, yes, the big thing about that is proper training. Every one of my teachers or every one of my students that take my courses, even my church training, they all have to have their weapons carry license or their carry permits, things of that nature like that. To answer your question, a lot of people are receptive to the proper training and people that have guns. So, and, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who don't want nothing to do with the guns, don't want nothing to do it. But however, you know, just like church training, the security team is the first responders to any type of situation. A pastor told me one time, he says, police or law enforcement is minutes away when seconds count. And so the teachers and the church security team members are their first responders, and they're going to, you know, stop the threat, minimize or isolate the situation.
talking again with Ronnie Smith with Georgia Firearms and Security Training Academy. And I know that you're getting ready to go through this training, Ronnie, but typically, you know, I mean, you obviously do this for a living. So you've been talking and doing training not only with teachers, but with pastors. And you know, when you are teaching these classes, what's the mindset of those students that you're running into? Are they eager to learn? Are they listening to you? Do they feel like they've got somewhere better to be? I mean, what can you just talk about, generally speaking, the folks who are showing up to get this training? What is their mindset?
Well, I've trained thousands of military and hundreds of police officers. These folks that we are training that are church security team members and the teachers, these are top notch. I mean, we're talking serious individuals that take this training very, very seriously. I vet them. We will talk to them tomorrow, and we're going to ask them some serious questions. Can you actually be able to do what you need to do in a time of, you know, time? Everybody, or as you know, everybody's going to act differently no matter what situation may occur.
Mm-hmm.
Time will tell on that. But however, at least they're challenging themselves to be able to go out there and do whatever they need to do. To answer your question, they are, my personal opinion, are the best students out there because they are on a mission.
Talking again with Rodney Smith and Rodney, you know, and I agree with you, by the way, you're right, because these are folks, again, the simple fact that they're volunteering to do this, I think understand, you know, it demonstrates that they're taking this seriously. I ran across a story out of Texas earlier today about a number of churches around the state that are taking down their no guns allowed signs. Now, they're not all changing their policies, but they're taking down their signs. And it's interesting. And the reasoning that they're giving, Ronnie, is they say this makes us a more attractive target to have this no guns allowed sign up. Now, again, they're not all changing their policy. All right. The Catholic Diocese of Dallas-Fort Worth, they're taking the signs down. But I guess it's like word of mouth. You're still not supposed to, you know, bring your legally carried firearm to church. And to me, like there's almost like a mental block there. Like, OK, we recognize that a no gun zone, or a gun free zone puts us more at risk. But we're going to pretend that we don't have a gun-free zone when in all actuality, we're still going to try to have one. We're just not going to advertise it.
I think I lost you.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that, Ronnie. I don't know how much of that you heard or did not hear, but you've got a number of churches around Texas that are taking their no-gun signs down. The signs they have to put up is required by law, but they're not actually changing their policies. They're still, you know, quietly, I guess, you know, word of mouth, they're saying, hey, you're still not allowed to bring your firearms here. But they recognize that having that sign up is like a big sign to people who want to do them harm, saying, hey, there aren't any guns here. And I'm just curious about the mental block of, well, we don't actually need to allow folks to carry. We just don't have to advertise that we're a gun-free zone.
Yeah, you know, the bad guys out there are doing all the shooting up. They might not be the sharpest tools in the shed, but they are not stupid. They know how to read. I mean, they know what they're doing. In fact, they do a lot of homework. Trust me, do a lot of homework. We do a lot. In fact, that's some of the stuff I teach my students is I'm an active shooter instructor, and you know, studies prove, you know, that they do their homework. Again, signs really don't mean anything. I'm not a big fan of putting signs down or having signs up anyhow. You know, the big thing is, though, a deterrent. Just like the after 911, we went through some major changes in the airports. You know, we had to go through metal detectors. By the way, there's air marshals on board. Oh, and also the pilots might be carrying a gun. And knock on wood, how many hijackings have we had since then just because a possible gun that could be on board at that point in time? Again, a deterrent. I'm a big fan of that.
Rodney Smith again with Georgia Firearms Academy and Security, with Georgia Firearms and Security Training Academy. Hey, Rodney, unfortunately, we are almost out of time, but thank you so much for coming on the program today, sir. Best of luck with the training. I hope the weather cooperates when you get outside. And thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And we're going to be in Joplin in 2 weeks doing some training over there, some churches over in Joplin, Missouri.
That is excellent, man. Well, we'll catch up with you again very soon. Rodney Smith joining us at GAFASTA.com, GAFASTA.com. And, you know, more on that story about the churches across Texas that are taking their No Guns Allowed signs down. I said that they're still maintaining their policy. Now, I don't know, honestly, how enforceable that's going to be, because under Texas law, you are required to post the premises. You're required to have that signage there. If you don't have the signage, you're not following the law. So this could get kind of complicated here. Apparently, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Archdiocese of that area will be posting the No Guns Allowed language in the church bulletin every week, as opposed to having a sign outside the door. Do you see a problem with that? When do you typically get the church bulletin? When you've entered into the church, right? Right. As you're on your way to the pew to sit down, you get the church program, and you sit down, and you open it up, and okay, I wonder what the reading is going to be, what hymns we're going to be singing today, and oh, this is a, I guess if you read the far enough down, you, oh, this is a No Guns Allowed zone. Do you then have to leave? Just supposed to try to remember that next time. Again, I don't know how this is going to work out practically, but it's worth noting that, again, they've recognized, a lot of these churches have, that having that sign there that says, hey, there aren't any legal gun owners on the premises, makes that a more attractive target. And good for them for recognizing that. But I would like them to take that next step of, let's go beyond just not advertising that we're a gun-free zone, and maybe we need to think about not being a gun-free zone to begin with. One other story out of Texas we'll talk about with A.W.R. Hawkins next hour, the fight over campus carry in Texas backed before a court of appeals not long ago. We'll talk about that and some of the other big Second Amendment stories with A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart right after a quick timeout. Stick around. There is much more Cam and Company on the way.
I'm here with Tom Burden, and he's with Grip Mat, the ultimate tool mat. Tom, welcome to the program. How are you?
Awesome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, so we're going to talk about what these are. Don't worry, we'll get there, everyone. Relax. But the first thing I have to say, Tom, the reason I met you here at the show, and I wanted to talk to you because I heard rumor that you're on Shark Tank. Is that true, Tom?
That is true.
All right, so I have to, you know, full disclosure, Tom, my daughter's a huge fan of Shark Tank. Like, she watches the new episodes, the reruns, like crazy, and she loves it. I watch with her sometimes, but I have to admit, Tom, I get tense because I can feel for you when you're in there.
Yeah.
It's got to be killer pressure.
It is a lot of pressure. So, yeah, basically how I started, I'm an F-16 mechanic in the Air Force.
Excellent.
I was tired of my tools sliding off the aircraft.
Thank you for your service.
Thanks for your support. And, yeah, so in my mom's car, she had a non-slip mat on her dashboard to keep her cell phone in place when driving. I was like, well, we can make these larger for tools. So was prototyping in my basement for a long time and then finally progressed, got it, brought it to market, was selling really well. And so, yeah, like you were saying, pressure from Shark Tank, you know.
All four of them, zing, 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 right. Zing, zing.
You know, I was, you know, went from making this in my basement to presenting it to billionaires. Oh. So, yeah, we had a guest shark, which was Richard Branson.
Wow. And, oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, so super exciting because, I mean, I was starting in aviation with the product.
Yeah.
So he owns an airlines company, so I was like, well, it's a perfect fit.
That's awesome.
Also, we sold it to NASA before we were on the show. So the thing is, he also owns a aerospace company, so that was, you know, a big perk for him as well.
So what happened? How did you do it? Did you make it? Did you get thrown out?
Well, I ended up getting three sharks to go into a combo deal, so I got Richard Branson, Mark Cuban, and Lori Grenier.
And and that all leads to you being here now, so that's awesome.
Yeah.
So speaking with Tom Burden with Grip Mat, the ultimate tool mat, so there's a couple different sizes and iterations here. Tell us a little bit about them, Tom.
Yeah, so we have the small, which basically has six different compartments to keep all your hardware organized. The medium, that has two small compartments to keep your hardware organized and an open field for hand tools. Also is equipped with a measuring with
inches. I noticed
that. Yeah.
So what's the function of that?
So basically, the grip mats are a very multi-purpose tool.
Right.
So anything that you need measuring for.
So say I have a bolt, I need an inch and a quarter. Boom.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great idea because I can never be sure with those, you know.
Right, right. And then also a lot of crafters will use this. Like someone was making jewelry
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. Or sometimes
like 8-inch chain or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. Or I've had some dentists use it, and then also in the medical industry. So if they do need a quick measurement, sometimes if it's not
like a 2-inch tooth,
that's a big tooth. Yeah. So if they just need a quick verification, then they'll throw it in there.
Bicuspid, by the way. Yeah, it must have been. All right. So Tom, tell us about the big guy over there.
Yeah. So this is the large, for those more intense
jobs. Hold
that
up for everyone to see.
So yeah. Has,
wow, that's cool.
Basically four compartments to keep your hardware organized, and then an open field for, more tools, where the medium is more for hand tools, if you got a power drill or anything like that.
I can see when you're doing a project, because I hate it when I'm doing a project and I have all the hardware, I'm taking something apart. I don't want to lose it. Small screws, this and that. And it'd be a perfect place just for all that to live while you're working on it.
Right. So, we really started in aviation, was growing into automotive, and then since Shark Tank, we've been checking out a lot of different industries, such as military, medical, and, the gun industry. So, with the combination of the three, a lot of people like to use it to break down their rifles or assemble it.
Yeah.
You don't want to sit on a table where it might get scratched, or, with an AR-15, you're typically losing a cotter pin.
Yeah.
If you're outside, drop that in the grass, your cotter pin's gone. So.
Cool. So we had a little bit of time left before we tell people how to get it. What's the material?
If I tell you, I'd have to kill you.
Secret, huh? I'm going to have to figure it out. Let's take one of these back to the lab, boys.
Yeah, it's a polymer silicone mix, so it's resistant to a lot of harsh chemicals used by mechanics, or basically a lot of people who are using it for their guns. They'll fill up one of the small compartments with cleaner and then just kind of
drop
those.
Oh, so you can do it like that? That's cool.
Yeah, so it really submerges and gets your pieces really clean.
That's awesome. Tom Burden, it's Grip Mat, the ultimate tool mat. How do we get more information about this, Tom?
Yeah, so you can find us on our website at www.grypmat.com. That's www.gripmat.com. So any type of form of social media, we're mostly strong on Facebook and Instagram, and then also our products on Amazon.
Thank you, sir. Great stuff, and congratulations on Shark Tank.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company. That is not what the mothership looks like outside right now. As a matter of fact, can we look live in the control room right now? I don't want to mess anything up. I don't want to break anything by doing so. But there you go. There's Cameron Gray in the dark because we have a power outage. And Justin and Katie, we can barely see you all. But it's good to know that you're still working here. Storms going through in the D.C. area. And I don't know how that's going to impact us here going forward, but we're going to be on. I don't know if Cameron and Katie and Justin are, but light a candle, y'all. In the meantime, we've got Dr. A.W. Hawkins of Breitbart with us on the program right now. Dr. Hawkins, how are you, sir?
Oh, doing great, Cam. Great to be with you.
Where the heck are you today? That looks awesome.
I'm sitting at a Riverview restaurant with Heidi on the Cumberland, and we're going to meet with Orca Coolers tomorrow, so we're just over here in the Nashville area hanging out today.
That's a good life you got there going on, Dr. Hawkins. Enjoy Nashville, and give our best to the folks at Orca. I am drinking from my Orca cooler right here, as a matter of fact, with my Texas State flag on it, picked up at the NRA annual meeting. And so be sure to tell them I said hello, will you?
I love Orca.
Listen, man, I do too. Not to turn this into an infomercial, but this thing, honestly, it keeps my drink colder longer than anything I've ever had before. The Orca coolers themselves are fantastic. So, yeah, I'm a big fan. And I got to tell you, man, at the NRA annual meeting, I was going to get one of these mugs. They've actually got them at the NRA store right now online, NRAstore.com. I went to the NRA store in person, the physical location, first day of the NRA annual meeting, and they had these coolers, but they were black. They had the NRA logo on them. They were spiffy, and I thought to myself, okay, I got to get one of those before I leave town. I didn't have a chance to go back to the store until Sunday. I asked. They're like, oh, no, we sold out of those Friday afternoon. They were long gone. They were incredibly popular there at the annual meeting.
Yeah, I love anything they make. Anything they make.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program today. We were talking just before the break about something going on in Texas, the fight for campus carry returned to a courtroom last week. You remember these college professors at UT Austin who said that having campus carry was actually a violation of their First Amendment rights?
as well as a violation of their Second Amendment rights because they were worried about, you know, students in the classroom getting angry about a grade or whipping out a gun because a classroom discussion got too heated. And their case was thrown out at the trial court level, but they're appealing this. And so this is back before a court of appeals, and they're arguing that Texas campus carry law should be struck down.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the thing. People act like campus carry comes out of a vacuum, and it doesn't. And these professors are no different. I've been following them. You know, they've had campus carry in Colorado since 2003. So go to Colorado, go to the records and look. Do you have students whipping out a gun because they got a bad grade? Do you have students whipping out a gun because their essay wasn't respected? I don't know. You don't have these kinds of issues. You know, I think since 2003, they had only one thing that could be categorized as a crime. Well, not even a crime. It was someone showed somebody a gun they were carrying. To me, to my knowledge, that's the only incident that happened in Colorado since 2003. And that person was a school employee and lost her job for doing that. And other than that, nothing's happened. So there's history to back up the safety of this. And these claims are crazy.
Talking again with our friend A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart. And it'll be interesting to see. I suspect that you're right, and I suspect that this is going to get tossed out of the Court of Appeals as well. Now, you also have a piece at Breitbart right now, this crazy story out of Las Vegas. We may even have some B-roll. No, I bet we can't play the B-roll right now because of the power situation there in the control room. But folks may have already seen this video from Las Vegas. This a shootout on the city streets of Las Vegas. I think it's something like 60 rounds exchanged between this armed suspect and the police officer who's following behind. Okay, so we've got the body cam or the dash cam video here. And at one point, you can see Dr. Hawkins, this officer, he's getting shot at, first of all, as he's right. Driving. So he takes out his gun and he's trying to shoot offhand, one-handed out the window. That doesn't work. So he quickly switches back to his dominant hand, his right hand, and ends up shooting through his windshield, trying to stop this attack. This is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Now, you've seen them do it before. I have. I know they get trained to put the end of their gun right against the windshield, and that way when they shoot, there's not as much room for deflection, and the shot is very accurate through the windshield. But it's a crazy video. And that officer is able to, by shooting, he's able to slow the vehicle down, and he gets close enough to it. He never gets alongside it, but he gets close enough that he can swing the gun around and shoot out of his passenger window. You'll see the video is about to catch up to that point. After these shots, he'll be able to get up next to the car, shoot through the window, and he kills one of the occupants, and one of the occupants is shot numerous times, has to be taken to the hospital. But this is some crazy police work right here.
There really are. And, you know, both of these individuals, I guess one of the individuals that was shot, was taken into custody, ended up dying. The second suspect now being charged with murder in the death of his accomplice there. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I was wondering when I saw this video, so when do we start to get the criticism of these officers should have backed off? These officers should not have continued to engage the suspect once they knew the suspect was armed and was firing shots. They should have broken off contact. And you actually are now starting to see a little bit of discussion here. I'm looking at a news story from KTNV talking about the mixed reaction. The mixed opinions vary on actions of Las Vegas police officers during the gun battle. So I guess there are actually folks who are saying, no, this never should have happened. The police just should have, when the bad guy started shooting, the police just should have backed off.
Huh. Well, I mean, that guy, I don't know which of the suspects did it. There was a Miranda and a Nunez in that vehicle. I don't know which one was doing the shooting, but they fired 34 shots at that officer. Now, what's he supposed to do? Because are they shooting so accurately that no bystanders are in danger? No. So he has to do something. Not only to save himself, but to save the bystanders. I don't even want to say he was thinking about himself. I don't think he would have done what he did if he was thinking about himself. And so I think people who complain here are silly because that officer obviously had to do something to stop this so that the bystanders would be saved.
talking to him with a friend, A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart News. And it should be noted as well, even the Las Vegas media says most people are praising these officers. But, it does make me wonder, Dr. Hawkins, you know, because we live in a day and age where, and a lot of this comes from folks on the left wanting body cameras. They wanted the immediate or near immediate availability of this video. And I think it's been helpful, but it also, look, now we all get to Monday morning quarterback. Whether right. we, you know, spent a career as a law enforcement officer or we got pulled over for speeding once, and that's the only contact we've had with law enforcement. Now we all get to Monday morning quarterback and we all get to say, oh, you know what, I would have done it differently.
Right. But, you know, if you think about this, Cam, when they were first doing body cams, I'm just going to be honest, and it's a mistake I made. I was against it. And I was like, well, why don't they let the criminals wear body cams? And, you know, but what I've learned, when you watch these cams, it's very rare that I can think of somebody, a police officer, who was proven wrong with a body cam. Most of the time, it does what you're saying. It literally puts us in right there with the officer. We see what he was going through, and we can critique it and disagree with his actions. But it proves these officers, this officer chased these individuals, was shot at 34 times before he ever returned fire. I'm always shocked at how calm they remain and just how focused. So I have nothing but praise for the officer. And I actually enjoy the body cams because I think it proves our officers are under control. And if anything, to me, they wait too long to use force very often. That's my opinion, but that is my opinion.
Again, talking with A.W.R. Hawkins. Now, you've got another story, Dr. Hawkins, about the L.A. Times today in an article or a column about Brett Kavanaugh. And why Californians should be concerned about Brett Kavanaugh, in large part because of his a dissenting opinion in the Heller 2 case, in which he said, I think D.C.'s ban on semi-automatic long guns, I think that's unconstitutional. I think this registration requirement, I think it goes too far. The Los Angeles Times, as you say, described commonly owned semi-automatic firearms as, quote, rapid fire weapons, right? They reclassified quote unquote assault weapons as rapid fire weapons, warning that a conservative court could overturn bans on quote rapid fire weapons.
They should have titled that column, "Hey, I've never touched a gun in my life, but I've seen drawings." That's what they should have titled that column. Yeah, he called semi-automatics rapid fires. Obviously, an attempt to make them look or sound ominous. And we've got to get rid of these. And wicked Mr. Kavanaugh is going to overturn bans on them. And anybody knows who has handled guns that a semi-automatic rifle, a semi-automatic handgun, or a double-action pistol, you can get almost the same rate of fire, almost identical out of any of them. Now, you may need a trigger job on the pistol. You may even need a trigger job on the semi-automatic handgun, but you can get an identical rate of fire out of them. And if you don't believe me, go to my piece at Breitbart, and you can watch Jerry shoot his revolver. I think he gets 8 shots off in 1 second, and then he does a reload situation where he gets 6 shots, then 6 more in 2.9 seconds. So these people don't understand guns. They're trying to scare the public. But what they have working against them is millions, not hundreds, not thousands, but millions of Americans own semi-automatic rifles. These are common weapons. They're in common use for self-defense, and they're not going anywhere. They're just not.
A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart. Listen, buddy, I appreciate you joining us on the program, sir. Go enjoy that beautiful Nashville afternoon, and we will talk to you again very soon, man.
Thank you, Cam. Great to be with you. You have a great day.
You too. A.W.R. Hawkins. Did you not just want to crawl through your computer screen there and just hang out at that open-air establishment with A.W.R. Hawkins? That looks like a place to while away an afternoon. Unlike, can we see the control room again real quick? Because this does not look like the place to while away an afternoon. You guys don't even have the candlelight going. I mean, I would have figured, you know, we'd have had like the soft rock playing.
Yeah.
Just you're sitting there in the dark. Sorry.
Your alt-rock favorites.
Exactly. Yacht Rock. Channel 30-something on Sirius XM.
Listen, Cam, we're in good company. Earlier, when President Trump was making his statement on intelligence in Russia, the lights went out at the White House. So if the lights can go out at the White House, how are we just miles away in Northern Virginia? How can we be exempt from our lights going out? So
But remember, tonight's it's the All-Star game here in D.C., and it is nasty right now. So who knows what's going to happen with that tonight.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about the All-Star game. And, you know, it's interesting. So two things about the All-Star game. First of all, is there anything more, Cameron, about the Metro employees striking?
I don't know. I haven't seen anything.
Okay.
I haven't seen an update.
Because I ran across a story, I think it was yesterday, the day before yesterday, where Metro employees, the public subway, the bus system, public transportation system, the employees of Metro had voted to strike. Now, they're not allowed to strike under their collective bargaining agreement, but they had voted to strike anyway, in violation of their collective bargaining agreement. And basically, they were threatening to just not show up and to go on strike last night and tonight. Last night, the All-Star, the home run derby, tonight, the All-Star game, and to just cause havoc there with the transportation system in D.C., I guess to prove that they shouldn't all be replaced by robots. I guess that's the point. I don't know. They're going to unsuck D.C.'s Metro by sucking it up even worse. I guess the plan. So I'm glad to know that they haven't struck yet. The other thing, Cameron, did you see the calls of the allegations of cheating by Bryce Harper at the Home Run Derby last night?
I didn't. I heard a little bit about it, and I got to say, I watched some of it last night. I turned on ESPN, first of all, for the pregame festivities, and it was Keith Olbermann. So it was just, I almost didn't turn it back on, but he was just doing the Sports Center ahead of time, so it's almost handleable. But then I turned it back on, and there was a thing where you couldn't hit the ball until the previous ball landed. There were some people taking some liberties with that. So I can see something pinky.
Bryce Harper took some liberties. If you listen to Cubs fans anyway, he took some liberties there. All right, stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up next.